You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Ken, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you for joining me.
Marty, finally. We've been kicking us around for a few weeks. I'm glad we were finally able to make it work.
As I was telling you, in the middle of a move, conference in the middle of that move. It's been a hectic week, but I think I'm finally settling in. As you can see, no bookshelf, but we have stacked books behind me. Hopefully they will be on shelves soon.
No, there are definitely ways. There are ways in the world to get, you know, to get credits on, what do you call it? We're good Catholics. You know, when you pass and they'll go to heaven. Come on.
Purgatory.
Thank you. Well, moving is purgatory credit. So I've done it many times in my life. So I feel for you.
Well, thank you. But I'm really excited for this conversation. And
likewise,
the event in a few weeks, the BPI event down in DC, the summit. We met about a month ago, 2 months ago now, at this point in Austin during the takeover. Yep. And Zach was very eager to introduce you to me, considering the history of the show, the topics we covered. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm excited for this because I'm infinitely curious to learn how somebody with your pedigree and your resume got into Bitcoin, is now working for the Bitcoin Policy Institute as the Director of Government Affairs. So for anybody listening who is unaware of Ken's resume, he did 20 years in government, culminating as Deputy Chief of Operations at the CIA Center for Cyber Intelligence. You've worked overseas for the U.S. State Department, and now you're advocating on behalf of Bitcoin on Capitol Hill. So how does somebody with that resume go from statecraft to cypherpunk? Sort of ideals.
Yeah, no. So I, like everybody else, my Bitcoin journey is a little bit, you know, everybody has a unique journey, right? Mine actually started CIA, believe it or not. And it was for purely professional reasons. So I was an operations officer. I spent most of my career overseas, as most of us do. But my last two tours at CIA, I was at the Center for Cyber Intelligence, which is CIA's cyber unit. And my first job there, I was a group chief. I was a operations chief for a group that worked on cyber threat issues. And this was in 2018. So you remember, this was when Lazarus Group, the North Koreans, figured out that stealing crypto was a lot easier than, like, you know, trying to rob banks. This is when ransomware broke out as a serious problem. Just preceded, you may remember, the Colonial Pipeline hack that shut down, you know, gasoline shipments to the East Coast. So in 2018. And it's kind of funny, like, people say, did the CIA create Bitcoin? I can tell you in 2018, when policymakers first had to confront it, its use by actors as an issue, like, nobody was ready for it. Like, if they created it, it was tucked away and hidden in the basement, because the bench for people with crypto knowledge in general, digital assets, certainly Bitcoin, was really, really, really shallow. I remember we had two guys who kind of had background in it, and then, you know, they became superstars because all of a sudden we were calling upon them to teach us about Bitcoin and digital assets in general. But yeah, so I learned, like everything else, I learned about it because I had to, because people we cared about were using it. But like everything else, there was sort of a mind virus to it. And I admit, you know, during COVID, I was in the altcoin casino. I was DeFiing and meme coining, and it was fun. You know, I don't hold any hate for the altcoiners. People do what they want with their money. But I, you know, that was when it was during COVID. I had been sort of buying it in 2018, but during COVID, when I really started learning, because this is what everybody learned, right? And I, you know, for me, Bitcoin was what really attracted me to it. And I was sort of inspired by, the COVID, the Kenyan trucker protest was something really important to me. I saw how it was being used. But also, sort of in my day job, you know, I had a pretty good understanding of how the government uses financial tools as a weapon, freezing bank accounts, OFAC sanctions, that kind of thing. And if you're on the, you know, on the giving end of that, that's great. Those are great tools to have if you're the government. Not so great if you're on the other end of it. And, you know, watching these Canadian truckers the first time, you know, you'd be able to, it's very easy to say, yeah, sanction the Iranians, sanction North Korea, whatever, you know, I'm not Iranian. But when you see all of a sudden Canadian truckers, people you had some sympathy with being targets of financial, you know, weaponization of the financial system, it struck a nerve, like a really, really profound stinging shot to my consciousness, about this issue. So for me, for the first thing about Bitcoin was permissionless transactions. That's what got me into it. And of course you go from there. And by the time I left the government in 2022, I was full bore. I was, you know, attending meetups, and that's when I started doing some advocacy stuff on Capitol Hill and messing around with Dave and Grant at PPI, doing some advocacy stuff. But it comes from my time at CIA, and yeah, I think what might surprise some people is there are a lot of Bitcoiners, not just at CIA, but across the whole national security establishment. And I think they're into it for the same reason that, you know, that everybody, most of your listeners are, right? Like, it's, you see what's happening in the world. You see the challenges we're facing. You see how governments use financial tools to weaponize them against opposition. You know, it's very natural that if you have that kind of insight that you look for things to protect yourself, and Bitcoin is obvious. So I tell a funny story. When I was first into it, there was a cubicle, one of the guys, and he had a bumper sticker. It said, "We are all Satoshi." This is in one of the, you know, one of the offices. And like, I know what that means. The guy's like, "Oh, you're a Bitcoiner?" "Yeah, dude, me too. And they come out, you know, and like everything else, when you're into it, you learn, you meet people. I was in Europe at a dinner with the chief of station, and he busted out his BlockFi card to pay for dinner. And I was like, "Wait a minute." He's like, "No, I take in Bitcoin, man. I take my rewards in Bitcoin." And there's two examples, but there are a lot of Bitcoiners across the national security establishment, and which to me makes perfect sense. I think a lot of listeners don't find that surprising, but they're there, and they're in it for the exact same reasons that everybody else is.
Well, I think the latter part there is what would be surprising to a lot of people. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm very excited to speak with you today, is to get better insight into how the government, particularly the intelligence apparatus, is approaching Bitcoin and crypto more broadly, especially as it pertains to sort of civil liberties and the right to transact permissionlessly. Because I think that's one thing as we look out at the industry now, particularly what's going on with Tornado Cash and Samurai Wallet, those cases, I think there's a lot of questions that Bitcoiners have, particularly around the attempt by the government to form fit laws that were written 50 years ago onto this new nation, yeah, unique asset in Bitcoin. And I think, I would imagine, Bitcoin existing and people using it in a peer-to-peer distributed fashion has to incite some uncomfortable questions of, hey, are we going to be able to continue to leverage these financial tools the way we have over the last 50 years, maybe go further back than that. And are we simply just going to have to concede that Bitcoin is this unique animal and reorient the way we approach, the way we approach enforcement of the laws? We've been saying it on this show in Rabbit Hole Recap for many years. I truly believe that Bitcoin, instead of trying to force it down the road of form-fitting it into Bank Secrecy Act and a lot of the regulations and laws that have stemmed from that, it's simply going to come down to law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies having to do better sort of detective work. The big worry is that you throw the baby out with the bathwater by trying to put the incumbent regulations on a system like Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I think it's first important to realize that, like, the national security establishment is not a monolith, right? It's big. It's as big as everyone thinks it is, but it encompasses whether it's the intelligence community, CIA, FBI, which, you know, despite what people think, is culturally very different from CIA, DOD, the Department of Defense, you know, the vast sort of octopus that is the military. So all these different units have these different pieces of it have different perspectives on what they look at. And I think these are also institutions, right, that have been around a long time. I think the sort of the idea that being able to transact freely, self-sovereignty is new, is a little bit of recency bias. I mean, I think it, my view is that it all sort of the things went bad after September 11th for a lot of reasons. I'm from New York. I took it very personally. But if you think they think to the evolution of how of the surveillance state and what's happened in government since 9/11, you get a flavor for how things went off the rails and how we can actually bring them back in a way that still, you know, America was a perfectly fine country in 1999. We survived perfectly well without all these tools of surveillance that were built in the aftermath of 9/11. And I get what happened. But I think the story of 9/11 and the evolution of not only the surveillance state, but also global politics since 9/11 sort of creates a sense among people, certainly younger people that maybe don't remember the pre-times, that these institutions are inherently anti basic ideas of sovereignty, basic ideas of the ability to transact, all the things that we care about in Bitcoin. But I do think now with President Trump and this sort of the cultural shift, and I think that's peaked during the Biden years. I remember just last year, I did a couple panels at the Bitcoin's Policy Summit last year before I was an employee, and we were fighting on our backs, you know, just struggling, you know, keep trying to stay in the fight. The tone shift in DC is remarkable, and I think a lot, and that's not just about Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is part of the general tone shift away from sort of this sort of this Goliath of a surveillance state that I think, you know, reasonable thinking people would agree was abused over the past couple of years, not just against people in digital asset space, but I mean, you know, if you're at a school board meeting and all of a sudden you're on an FBI terrorist list because you spoke out at a school board meeting, that's problematic, right? And I think people have, and I think we've arrive at a sea change. Bitcoin's going to benefit from that, and I think it's actually part of one of the bigger wins in the sales behind that. But I think the idea that sort of these institutions are inherently, certainly the national security sector, inherently against these things is again reflects a little bit of recency bias.
Yeah, and I think that's encouraging to hear. It's like, how in your mind, what do you think needs to happen within these 4 years to really cement that mindset into the minds of not only yourself and Bitcoiners, but the American people more broadly?
Yeah, I think on some level, I mean, it's going to be also on these institutions to prove it, right? Like there was no, like, I'll give you an example, like the letter that like these former CIA officers signed, you know, saying that Trump, it was Russian propaganda, did no favors. And then, you know, I feel bad. I mean, I'll be honest. Like one of the people who signed that letter, I had worked for him early in my career and knew him, and he was very good to me. Right. So it was really sort of disappointing, and I didn't like seeing him on that letter. And even though that wasn't CIA's letter, right, these are former officers who are entitled to speak their mind, they wrote in such a way that gave the impression that it was sort of their official opinion. And I think that things like that erode a lot of trust. And I think the best thing that, for example, CIA, but the entire national security establishment can do is just to deal fairly with people, speak the truth, and also don't abuse your powers. I think a lot of what happened, I have a lot of friends at FBI, and they're really good people at FBI, good Americans who honor their oaths to the Constitution. But when you become a fixture in Washington, D.C., I think CIA benefits from being across the river in Virginia, in ways that like FBI does not benefit being stuck on Pennsylvania Avenue right between Congress and the White House. I think it's important these institutions, that the leadership of these institutions hold themselves accountable for some of the things that have happened in the past. More importantly, just do your job well. I think people will understand that these institutions are important, but just do your job well, do it honestly. Don't mess around. Don't get cute with people's rights. And I think all of a sudden you'll see a sea change. I think, for example, we have Deputy Director of CIA coming to our summit on June 25th. You know, and I don't know exactly what he's going to say, but he's not coming to talk about censorship or censoring, you know, OFAC compliant blocks. He's going to come and talk about why Bitcoin's important for the future of the United States. And I think things like this, gestures like this from the national security establishment to not just the Bitcoin community, but to the country, will go a long way in reestablishing trust.
Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got two secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a cold card queue. Go to coinkite.com, find the cold card queue, use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the cold card queue. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, that's going back to what you originally said in the beginning of the conversation and handily debunked that the CIA created Bitcoin. And that when you hear that theory, it's often sort of set up with the idea that like back in the early 2000s, post 9/11, the CIA was running war games at the Pentagon, looking at the debt, looking at the money that was going to need to be printed, especially considering what happened in 2008. And they launched Bitcoin as a way to create a strategic advantage for the U.S. in the long run. That's one of the theories that's put out there. If you are one of the ones like Catherine Austin Fitz, who believes that the CIA created Bitcoin, but even if that's debunked, is that sort of how the CIA views Bitcoin as a strategic economic asset that could play into the massive benefit of American citizens and the United States overall?
I do. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, CIA is not a policy organization, right? It's an intelligence organization. Its job is to know the truth, right? And report that to policymakers. I think most people at CIA, if they're involved with Bitcoin, it's because there are foreign actors using it to do things. I mean, that's just the reality, right? Like it's foreign actors use Bitcoin to move money, to do all sorts of things. That we have to accept that. That's part of having your freedom protocol. Everybody can use it. But I think there's a larger, and the national security establishment is ahead of the rest. Certainly they're ahead of Congress on this. The basic idea of the impossibility of the current monetary system continuing as it has been since, we'll call it 1971, but maybe possibly longer, is a threat to national security. And what options are available that fit within sort of a core plateau of American values to help get us out of this situation. And this is why I think, I'll be honest with you, I haven't met a lot of gold bugs in CIA. I'm sure they're there. I've not. But, you know, if you're looking for solutions in a world where dollar dominance slides, our adversaries aren't holding treasuries like they used to, maybe the rest of the world has decided that they want to de-risk a little bit from their U.S. holdings and don't want to have their national wealth stored in a bank in New York City. What are the options? And this is what the kinds of things CIA will think about. What are the options? Where are these actors go? Where do we go? Bitcoin is a natural option. It's digital. It fits in the modern world. You can self-custody it. It's permissionless. These are the sorts of things when you sort of game out and red team, where will the world go? Or for example, how do we compete with China, right? Which is building their sort of parallel system in the world. What are our options for building a backdrop, building a set of options to deal with that? Bitcoin's a natural option.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I think about it, there's three things that really stand out. Number one, how young Bitcoin is and if it does truly compete with global currencies, reserve assets, and we're still at the beginning stages of adoption. You have this incredible upside asymmetric opportunity to get in early and benefit from the adoption wave. Two, I think River posted a report just last month or a few weeks ago, basically highlighting that American hold the most Bitcoin per capita, the most businesses focused on Bitcoin are starting in the United States. We have the largest percentage of hash rate in any individual country here in the United States. And so in the private sector, we have an incredible advantage already just in the first 16 years. And then three, if you think about this playing out, adoption does continue at the pace that it has over the first 16 years since the protocol launched. And it does become a formidable reserve asset that competes. Like, does having a neutral reserve asset that cannot be controlled by any individual country, company, group of people, does that change the game theory of geopolitics in a positive way?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think you have to look at where, you know, what offers us competitive advantage, comparable advantage, right? Do we have, compared to China or Russia, do we have a comparable advantage in gold? No, I don't think so. We have no natural advantages in gold. Does Bitcoin speak to our comparable advantages? We do hope that, you know, as we look at where we can go, you know, are we going to look at options that speak to what I think still remain core US, core American principles, right? Freedom, private property. Bitcoin is a big, in my mind, and I think in the mind of a lot of people in the national security sector, Bitcoin hits all those points, right? We have a natural advantage in it because of mining. It is, on some level, it's a technical protocol in which we excel. And most importantly, it does not undermine U.S. values. It actually strengthens U.S. values. One of the reasons why I think China can never become a superpower, a Bitcoin superpower, is because at the end of the day, Bitcoin undermines the authority of the Chinese Communist Party. If you're a dictatorship, you don't want people having sovereign wealth. Thus, Bitcoin is not a good option for China, which is why that they're looking to build their alternate system in their cross-border payment systems and some of the other, and Belt and Road, some of the things that they're working on. Conversely, for the United States, you know, a protocol that encourages self-sovereignty, that allows people to control their wealth, permissionless, you know, speaks to what I still hope there's a basic consensus in the United States that these are American values. And Bitcoin understates all those.
Yeah. I really hope those values still exist at some level. Yeah.
I think so. And I think you're seeing it. So again, it's interesting, Marty. Like, I think back to like last year, going sort of talking about politics a little bit, where we were in Capitol Hill and sort of the environment about the policy establishment still doesn't look, they're learning that Bitcoin and crypto are different. I think Trump's executive order went a long, long way in establishing that fact, that Bitcoin is different than everything else. Because people sort of get that conceptually now. But the reception that we get on Capitol Hill among policymakers, there's no longer discussions about, is this just criminal money? Is it fake? Can it be stolen? All the things you talked about, is it only for buying drugs? All the sorts of discussions we had just not that long ago, a year ago, about Bitcoin. Now the questions we get are, talk me through why it's good for national security. Talk to me why this will not undermine U.S. global monetary dominance. Walk me through how this encourages other countries not to join the Belt and Road or China's parallel systems. These are the kind of discussions we're having now. But the basic premise is, no, they're not questioning whether Bitcoin's going to exist or whether it should exist. They're asking about the kinds of things it can do. That is a huge, huge shift from where we were a year ago, where basic questions about, like, will this thing be around in 10 years? And can it be stolen? And what if Satoshi comes back and, you know, and hits reboot? You know, what happens? You know, basic education, we're way past that now, where you have, and it is largely a bipartisan consensus, not entirely, but more and more, that Bitcoin's here to stay, and they're asking really smart, educated questions about how Bitcoin can address these certain policy challenges that no longer include, is it just for buying drugs on Silk Road, which is a huge, huge policy shift just in a matter of a couple of months.
Is Bitcoin's next parabolic move already starting? Two of the strongest historical indicators, global M2 liquidity and the copper to gold ratio, are flashing green again. Unchained and TechDev break it all down in the new report, Bitcoin's Next Parabolic Move. Could liquidity lead the way? If you care about the macro forces shaping Bitcoin's trajectory, now's the time to pay attention. Visit unchained.com/TFTC to read the full report. That's unchained.com/TFTC.
I mean, and with that in mind, I mean, as the director of government affairs at BPI, I think it's become pretty clear over the last 2 years, specifically leading up to last year's election, that a bunch of individuals in the industry sort of became privy to the fact that you may not care about political power, but political power cares about you. And if you accept that. It makes sense to interact with politicians, no matter, despite the fact that you may be an anarcho-capitalist that is in this for the cypherpunk ideals that Bitcoin was founded on. But you can either ignore the reality of political power or engage with it. And I think with that in mind, what have Bitcoiners been doing right? What have they been doing wrong? And how should the industry be interacting with the government as it tries to wrap its head around Bitcoin? How it can impact the U.S. economy?
Yeah, so to speak to your earlier point, so when you're like involved in sort of Bitcoin clubs, bit devs in D.C. area, it's a little bit different than the rest of the country because a lot of government people, a lot of military people, right? So it was a lot easier to sort of, when you're, you know, broing out with your Bitcoin friends, a lot of people in this area have sort of basic frames or sort of similar frames of reference. I'll tell you where I had some great discussions though was in Austin at the mining summit, because, you know, these are people that don't live in DC. Most of them, you know, just want the federal government to leave them alone. They had these kinds of discussions. And my point to people like that is always Bitcoin is resistance money. But you don't want to have to put that to the test. I think people that use Bitcoin's resistance money would much rather be in a situation where Bitcoin is a savings tool for them. It's a way to store wealth, all the other reasons where people like us look at, you know, the advantages that we enjoy at Bitcoin. We don't have to worry about it being resistance money. And if you neglect the political process, you could find yourself in a situation where Bitcoin becomes resistance money. And I don't want to live in a country where it becomes resistance money. It's a bad scene. So I think people accept the basic fact that the government can't stop it, but you really want to be in a position where you're putting yourself in legal jeopardy to be able to use Bitcoin. When, had you thought about this a couple of years ago, you could have participated in the process, called your congressman, gone to summits, all the things we're doing. And instead of letting it get to that point, Bitcoin becomes a legal, accepted, widely traded, widely used tool in the United States. So yeah, my point is always, you know, let's not test the resistance money thesis in the United States. It plays that role in a lot of countries, and thank God it's there for those people. But really, if we could not get there in America, that'd be much better. To your other point, I think I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you got it.
I think to your other, the second part of your question, what are we doing right? I think the industry has, I've had the chance to see this sort of in my new job. There are a lot of big brains in the Bitcoin business, a lot. And I think that I think there's been a growing, and it has a lot to do with the fact that DC is no longer hostile. But I think there's been a growing acceptance of leaders in this industry, people, whether they're building protocols, long-term holders, sort of Bitcoin OGs, but the willingness of people like that to actually talk to policymakers is going a long, long way, because there's no longer this sort of adversarial view of the government. And the government has been adversarial. I'm not discounting their experiences. I mean, last year, the government was an adversary. It just was. That's just the way it is. That's changed. And I've been impressed that sort of industry leaders have pivoted really quickly and are taking on the challenge of coming to DC, meeting with members of Congress, sitting through discussions. That's great. You know, that again, that wasn't happening. Some people were doing it, but across the board, I know the people that the BPI supports, a lot of people that you included, are willing to come here and have these discussions with policy people. It brings you, makes you part of the process. And all of a sudden through that, you do find that you actually have some natural allies, not just in the administration, but also on Capitol Hill. And that has been, I think that showed a certain maturity of the sort of the Bitcoin culture, where industry leaders are willing to come here, and not just leaders, but, you know, we have a day on the Hill on the second day of our summit, and we have, you know, great signups, people from all over the country coming. They want to go meet the representatives, talk to them about Bitcoin. That goes a long, long way. And I think people were skeptical that, if I call my congressman, is he really going to care? But if you call a congressman and you say, we have a Bitcoin meetup, we meet every month and we get 50, 60 people, they start to care. It starts to matter, right? When most campaigns in this country are decided by a couple thousand votes. But that basic cultural shift in Bitcoiners from plebs to industry, being able and willing to engage with DC policymakers, has gone a long, long way. Because at the end of the day, even if they want to support you, you have to help them get there, right? They have to know that someone's got their back. If they're going to step out on a ledge, they need to know that there are supporters out there that will have their back if it gets, if there's a political political disagreements about this. So that for me has been a radical shift, and it happened really, really quickly. And I think that Bitcoin, the community in general is definitely benefiting from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like it was very wise to start that initiative or to change mind on the approach to interacting with the government years ago, because I mean, there are big battles. Say, I mentioned them earlier, the Tornado Cash developers and the Samurai developers are going through some cases. And I think we have the Blockchain Digital Clarity Act that is potentially going to be presented to the House. And I believe over the weekend, there was an amendment made to a bill that's already on the floor that sort of integrates mm-hmm. a lot of the language of the Blockchain Clarity Act. And at the same time, you had the Secret Service last week tweeting out a conflation of centralized mixers and CoinJoin transactions, which yeah. I said on Rabbit Hole Recap is a red line that we need to defend, that you can't really be throwing people in jail for writing software that allows people to use Bitcoin in a self-sovereign fashion without having control. As the person who wrote that software, I think it's pretty clear that both the Tornado Cash and Samurai cases, that the software they built made it so they never had control of funds. And obviously the DOJ under Biden went to FinCEN and asked, do you think these are money transmitters? They said no. Mm-hmm. And they went forward with the case anyway. And then fast forward to last week, you had the Secret Service come out and sort of doubling down on this. So as it pertains to this idea of the ability of open source software developers to write code that allows Bitcoin or Bitcoiners to use the protocol in a way that preserves their privacy, how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, so we're lucky. Secret Service is a law enforcement entity. They don't make laws. They enforce laws. So, you know, their guidance is, I think it was, it's kind of interesting to me how that got out and why they put it out. It's, you know, at BPI, you know, our job is to sort of be there and refute these sorts of things. From our perspective, it's unclear what happened in Secret Service, why that happened, but just because they say it doesn't make it law, doesn't make it the rule. The larger point, though, are Tornado Cash and Samurai. I mean, I think you're familiar with you know, as you referenced the DOJ's just blatant decision to ignore guidance from FinCEN about the status of these protocols. But I think at the end of the day, this is the remnants. And my personal opinion, I'm confident that this is going to work itself out in the courts. But this was the Biden administration wanting to set precedent. They couldn't get DAMLA through. Elizabeth Warren couldn't get her bills through Congress. So they're looking to set precedent through the legal system, which frankly is not the way it's supposed to work, but happens all the time. So we think a lot about that. I think the BRCA, the Blockchain Regulatory Clarity Act, Certainty Act, rather, I'm sorry, and even now the Big Beautiful Bill, which you referenced, you know, Senator Lummis has added some essentially some components of BRCA into that bill. We'll see. We're working on that to see what happens if we can get that through the process. There's a very deliberate policy move right now to make sure that using the legal system to set precedent when law hasn't caught up is avoided. And BRCA is an important part of that. And if, you know, whatever BRCA is, just, you know, it's some of its parts, right? If we can get those components into the tax bill, all the better. If not, you know, come the fall, we'll take up BRCA and work with Congressman Amber and Congressman Torres to get that through the House and into the Senate.
Yeah, well, pulling on this thread, there's a lot of people in the industry think there needs to be a sense of urgency to get bills passed within this administration specifically. Obviously, we had the executive order for the Strategic Reserve quickly after Trump was inaugurated. We've had a sort of verbalized agreement, or not even agreement, the Trump administration has said, we're ending Operation Choke Point 2.0, we're not going to attack you. And many people are very excited about these developments, however, cognizant of the fact that due to the nature of politics in the United States in 2025 and the 21st century, things tend to flip-flop a lot unless something is enshrined into law. We could just have a temporary sort of lull in the attacks on the industry here until the next administration gets in, whether that's another Republican administration or a Democrat administration that wants to be more combative with the industry is yet to be determined. But I think we're all in agreement that it would make sense just to not have to worry about who's going to be president or which party is going to be in control 4 years from now.
Yeah. And there's the reality of like working in DC is there's a billion priorities and, you know, our industry gets, 0.5% of their brain power, right, to pay attention to our priorities. And this is why what we discussed earlier about how the industry's changed, that's why it's important, because the loudest voices really are the ones that get heard. And loudest can be, you know, numbers of activists, loudest can be the most money contributed. But the loudest voices get heard in DC. And this is what BPI's core mission is, right? Is to stay in these people's faces and let them know we have a very active, committed group of Bitcoiners who will either support you or oppose you depending on how you treat this industry. And you're constantly fighting for attention. And this is why things like the Bitcoin conference, having JD Vance, the Bitcoin conference, for example, sends a message to the Republican Party, right? This administration is pro Bitcoin. So, you know, you may or may not care about it, but we need you on board. And then our, you know, the Bitcoin policy summit on June 25th, these are really, really important because this is how DC like talks to itself through conferences, getting in front of people, watch, you know, different policymakers looking for signals. Oh, this senator was here. Oh, the deputy director of CIA was there. He said this, maybe we care. You know what I mean? And then, so it's a flywheel effect of always being in people's faces and not just talking to Treasury, right? Bitcoin. I think one of the sort of the unfortunate events, the unfortunate sort of inevitable, was that Bitcoin, thinking about Bitcoin policy was sort of relegated, a better word, to, you know, FinCEN and Treasury and finance people. So when Bitcoin's a lot bigger than that. And I think the fact now you have the intelligence community, Department of Defense, I mean, there are some people, Marty, at the DOD thinking really deeply and smartly about this, what it means for global competition. What does mining mean? How do we use mining for energy resilience? There are people thinking, even the Department of Energy, some of whom will be at our conference, thinking really deeply about everything this ecosystem has to offer and how we can apply it to sort of a comprehensive national security strategy. But at the end of the day, though, we remain competing for limited attention. There's a lot going on, right? We accept that we're not the only thing in town. It's very important to us, but other people have other priorities. It's always being in people's faces. It's constantly letting people know that this community is out there. And we'll be your best friend or will be the biggest pain in the ass if you propose things that we think are right. And it at some point it does come down to that, right? Like there are people we disagree with. Sometimes it doesn't matter, but sometimes it does. And the Bitcoin community needs to be up there ready to fight for what they believe in and to be part of the process. And I think, you know, right now, we are front and center. We have all momentum. And you have the vice president at a Bitcoin conference talking about how this is a national priority. You don't get much better than that when you're signaling to your party. The challenge we have, of course, is, you know, we don't want Bitcoin to be, it's not a partisan issue, right? I heard people say Bitcoin's not political. I disagree. I think it is political, but it's not partisan. It's not the same thing. I'm in a suit today because after this, you know, I'm going to Capitol Hill to meet with an office of a Democrat senator who kind of wants to be supportive of this industry, right? But, you know, they live in their own universe as well. You know, they don't want to be seen as, you know, being aligned with White House priorities. So our job is to give them space and find a way for them to express that support. In a way, we have to be realistic, right? We can't expect, you know, members of different parties to get up and align with it. It's just not the way DC works. You have to accept that. But we need to give people space, these members space who want to engage. And that starts, I'll be honest with you, starts with telling them there's no litmus test here. We have some really basic core principles. I think BRCA kind of outlines those. But if you don't want to support the SBR, I mean, okay, that's fine. Like, there are Bitcoiners that don't like it, right? We can, you know, that doesn't mean you're this industry has to be your enemy. But we're looking for sort of, we do have a core set of principles that we are looking for people to abide by. I think BRCA is a good example. But we need to give these sort of middle people space to support the industry. Because that's how you get an enduring majority. That's how you make sure next time the White House flips, and eventually will flip, Congress will flip, that we have friends that see Bitcoin as being sort of in their interest, and also they've built relationships with the community. They know who to talk to, and you know we continue to get the treatment that we think that the industry deserves.
Does your pitch change depending on who you're speaking with? Like I find personally. When I'm pitching Bitcoin to people who are in finance or more right leaning, it's hard money, only ever be 21 million, government can't mess with it. And then left leaning, just point to Alex Gladstein, the Human Rights Foundation. Like if you're for activism in building up the global South and giving people financial freedom and access mm-hmm. to tools that they don't have access to, like this is a great protocol for that as well.
Yeah, 100%, and that's the beauty of this thing, right? Like, if the most important thing on your agenda is energy resilience, well, I've got a great story for you, right? What Bitcoin mining can do for you. If you're the most important thing you care about, human rights, or bringing disenfranchised people into the financial system, I've got a great story for you. And then, of course, you know, you're sort of the traditional sort of, you know, like you said, you know, crypto anarchic libertarians. Yeah, they're already our friends, right? They get the story. But you have to, because again, I mean, these members are human, right? They have their own personal interests. They can't be interested in everything. You need to meet them where they are. And if they're in my concern is making sure that people that have who don't have access to the banking system have access to financial services. Yeah, well, that's what we'll talk about. And it's not, you know, there's nothing disingenuous about that, right? Bitcoin does that, for example. Human rights, you know, my goal is to support human rights activists around the world. Bitcoin does that. You can have an honest conversation, let people know how Bitcoin can serve that purpose. So yeah, you have to meet them where they are. Because again, if you go to a progressive and you're like 20 million, no inflation, you know, the government can't control it, like, give me something else, right? I'm not sure about that. I don't care about that. Let's talk about these other things. Yeah, you meet people where they are. That's the important thing. And then the idea of being, again, and I subscribe to this. Yeah, you know, I think there's been a lot of discussion. We were actually going back and forth on Twitter yesterday. You know, I don't think at the end of the day, I don't think there will be either institutions are going to capture Bitcoin or Bitcoin's going to capture institutions. I really believe that, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, right? I'm at BPI because I believe that, and I think that Bitcoin and its incentives are powerful enough that if it is granted entry in these institutions, it will affect how they're ultimately formed and built and function. The alternative is it's captured by institutions, which we don't want. I really believe that, and I think that. The best way to do that, again, you have to get in the door, and you speak to people where they are. But at the end of the day, at its sort of base core level, for me, that this is the ultimate thing BPI is working on, right? Either institutions capture Bitcoin or Bitcoin captures institutions. And you know, our perspective is that Bitcoin will win. Bitcoin will capture institutions to the benefit of all of us. But you know, it's a battle, and you know, this is what we do here.
Well, let's paint that picture. What does it look like when Bitcoin captures the institutions?
So you mean when the dog catches the car? Mm-hmm. It's kind of, yeah, exactly. You know, just to tell you a story, but it's funny. When I started here back in February, you know, we had all these plans about this is what we're going to do with BPI, and we're going to do the SBR, and all of a sudden, you know, we got in, and then Trump completely front ran us and, you know, did it. Good problem to have. But I think right now, to answer your question, you know, I think Doge, if you look at what Doge did, and people, we can quibble whether Doge was successful or not, but certainly it did shine a spotlight on some of the how twisted and perverted the incentives and the institutions have become. The primary incentive is just to continue status quo and do nothing. There's been a gross reliance on across the government, and I actually think that, you know, that there are for the national security sector is probably the most responsible in this regard. But certainly the incentives across federal agencies have been to continue business as usual, not to challenge the status quo, no concern with efficiency, and just to continue spending money. When all of a sudden you bring Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is not just, it's not just you can't print it, right? It brings more to it. It brings a sense of responsibility. It brings a sense of, it brings value back to dollars. Because right now, a lot of federal agencies, I'll give you an example. You know, if you're in a federal agency, you know, the fiscal years are, you know, October 1st through September, the end of September, right? That's the government fiscal year. Everybody gets it come July. It's like, what's your spending rate? Oh, you're spending too slow. Spend. There's no incentive not to spend. The incentive is to spend and protect your budgets so you get the same next year, or the sort of the you know, the requisite 5% increase that everybody wants. You know, you bring sort of the basic principles of Bitcoin into that discussion. And it simply changes the way people view the world. Right now, money is, there's no real appreciation for people. Money is just a way to, in government, to, it's about continuity, right? It's about doing what you're doing, continuing your programs, the results be damned. When you bring different incentives into that, where the money they spend is actually valued, I think you'll get better outcomes. I also think that there's a general, this is across the Western world, there's a general sort of drift toward statism, sort of soft authoritarianism, whether it's censorship or, you know, well-trod territory, right? You know, when you bring Bitcoin into discussion and Bitcoin becomes part of a national strategy, you know, those things are incompatible. And I think that when people understand, when they see the benefits Bitcoin does bring, you know, it makes these other things that they've been interested in the past untenable. So again, I hear it a lot from Bitcoiners, you know, Bitcoin has no role in the government. Why are you doing this? I go back to the fact that one side's going to win, either institutions are going to win or Bitcoin's going to win. But we do fundamentally on some level need institutions to, you know, to make the country run. We want those institutions to be properly incentivized. I think Bitcoin does that.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's a brain dead theory or a pipe dream, but as somebody who prefers small government, small federal government, allocate everything to the states, let states' rights lead the way when it comes to the topic of something like a strategic Bitcoin reserve and how to acquire it via a mechanism like Bitbonds, that excites me, because to your points about individual agency budgets and just the unfettered access to increasing amounts of money.
Endless.
I think there could be a way to get smaller government, but it has to be via Bitcoin, where you take care of the debt problem over the long term. It'll take decades to do it, but ultimately the government grows at the rate that it is because of the debt problem itself to a certain extent. And if you really truly care about manifesting a smaller government, the best way to do that is to help them take care of their debt problem so that they're not forced to expand at the rate that they have been in recent decades. And that's something that really excites me. And then you mentioned Department of Defense, Department of Energy, thinking about mining and its implications. And we've already seen it in Texas, Tennessee, many states, like the mining industry has become critical parts of their energy infrastructure, has allowed them to expand capacity and made them more individually resilient as states and grid systems. And if you begin implementing it in all these different ways, that's the beauty of it too. It's so multifaceted. It can be plugged into many different areas of the economy. That you can, again, might be a pipe dream, but I'm an idealist, optimistic person, I guess. And when you look at the problems and think of the ways to solve them, like Bitcoin, to me, is honestly one of the only ways to actually solve these problems in the long term.
Yeah, and for me, people also ask me, like, what's it done for you? I mean, it, at the end of the day, for me, Bitcoin has made it easy not to be cynical, especially when you work in government, especially with my line of work. I mean, it's easy to become cynical because things are just constantly breaking. But when you do see something that offers a path, maybe, you know, it's a bit of a return to normal. It can't help. If you have any like sort of optimism inside you, it can't help but erase cynicism. And I think one of the goofiest things I think early Bitcoiners like save the money, save the world. That sounds really goofy when you first get into Bitcoin. Like, what does that mean? But the longer you're into it, it starts to make sense. Because again, you see all the destructive incentives that the basement has allowed to fester in Washington, D.C. Again, like the whatever cool about Doge, but Doge showed some of it, and there's a lot more of it. When you find a something, call it a tool, that can revert, can reverse that rot, can re-incentivize people to be productive, both their time and their resources. How do you not be optimistic? This for me is, I think, you know, in 10 years, this is, Bitcoin's either at $1 million or it's $0, right? Like it has to go, it can't not do one or the other, my personal opinion, right? Either a million or zero, or higher and higher and higher, because of all the things Bitcoiners know. But when you do get a basic consensus among policy people, and not just policy people, but also sort of the body politic, when you get a basic consensus about something that people think is regenerative, they're going to flock to it. I say one of among the controversial things I've told my Bitcoin friends, like the Bitcoiner of 2024, Gary DeFore, was Larry Fink. Like the guy, you know, regardless of what you thought of where he was before, whether it's disingenuous or not, he did some serious thinking and he changed and he opened the door for normies to get into this line of work. When I hear him talk about Bitcoin, whether it's fake or not, but he gets it. He's clearly done some big thinking, and it's not easy for a guy to change his mind, do it publicly. Still waiting on Jamie Dimon. But I think that when you see someone like Larry Fink, literally a pillar of the financial system, flip, and not just flip, like, okay, fine, we'll sell it because we can make money off of it. But like, no, we're going to allocate to this because we believe in its properties and we believe in what it offers, not just our company, but the financial system. That's a huge, huge shift. And I think people, my father was a Wall Street guy. I grew up in New York. My father was a Wall Street guy. He's 83 years old, and I try to kind of walk him through this, and he gets the basic incentives. But when Larry Fink switched, you know, I heard it from him, like, oh my God, had that happened, Dad, I told you. It's those, and the good thing, I think the community is generally speaking opening toward people, penance, right? You oppose it, now you like it. And at one point we all opposed it, right? If you asked me 10 years ago, would you buy Bitcoin? I'm like, what are you talking about? It's fake internet money. The community has been is welcoming to converts and to penance. But we see these major shifts. And I think Larry Fink was a pivotal shift. Just like I think when you have the deputy director of CIA coming to talk to a Bitcoin conference about Bitcoin policy, that's a huge shift, right? That these send signals to the world that there are important parts of the U.S. establishment, institutions that see this for what it is, and they're adopting it, and they're thinking about it, and they see its power, and we better too, because, I mean, why else would these institutions be doing that? Would BlackRock really sink that much cash, that much capital, that much credibility into someone they didn't believe in just for money? I don't think so. Would Michael Ellis spent half his day coming to a Bitcoin policy summit because he just thought it was cool and trendy and the White House liked it? I don't think so.
It's almost as if everybody finally found the 2017 meme from Bitstein, Bitcoin, the only winning move is to play. Especially if
Marty,
you
it's Marty, you're a husband, album. You're a husband and a parent. You know it's not often you get to be right, so like savor it. I savor it.
I completely agree. I think it's completely binary, and I'm wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I didn't believe that the binary outcome was going to be the successful one. And yeah, if that's true, it's going to be massive, not only for us individually as Bitcoiners, but for society at large. And it is really exciting. And I've been extremely pleasantly oversurprised with the work that BPI has done and the effect that it has had on policy discussions. I mean, you're mentioning J.D. Vance and his appearance at the conference being very humble. I mean, he mentioned Bitcoin Policy Institute.
That was cool. That was cool.
That's one thing I'm curious, and I won't pretend to be some sort of DC sleuth that's very privy to the inner workings of all these different think tanks and their influence on policy, but you hear them, the Brookings Institute, Rand, Hoover, Cato, you hear a lot, and behind the scenes, they basically get lambasted and made fun of as just academic people who put things out there and never actually change things, at least for the most part. Maybe every once in a while, they do have some influence that gets implemented into policy, but it seems like BPI to me has been outpunching its weight class as an early institution. And obviously you're biased as a director of government affairs, but as somebody who's been engrossed in DC culture for many decades, is that a correct characterization in your mind?
I mean, it helps when you're like, when you're shilling a good product, right? Like that, that does help. No, yeah, it does. And I think, you know, there's some of these institutions, like you've been to DC, like you drive down K Street, you've got these massive buildings, you know, full of hundreds of people. You mentioned Brookings or Heritage, you know, full of former generals and former deputy secretaries of this and that, sort of. But they're, you know, but I think a lot of what BPI's appeal has been a lot of these institutions, these sort of stalwarts of the DC policy scene. You know, they've been not challenging any core narratives. Yes, Brookings is a little bit left and Heritage is a little bit right, and they have different opinions about healthcare, they have different opinions about tax policy, right? But all sort of within that sort of traditional Overton window of what has been sort of accepted in polite cocktail company in Washington for the past how many years. You know, BPI is a little different. You know, we're 11, 12 employees now. You know, I think part of it is we're just telling a different story. And we're lucky, and I joke, we're shilling a good product, but you know, when people think back to, and everybody has a story about when they first heard of Bitcoin, it's kind of actually cool when you talk to staffers and they tell you, no, some of my friend told me I should have bought it back in 2018 and you know, I didn't, I'm stupid. But our story is completely different, right? And it's sort of, I don't know that BPI would be successful as it has been 5 years ago, because the culture just wasn't ready for it, right? There was no talk like you hear now and on basic in regular TradFi, right? Fiat debasement. That's a word you never heard 5 years ago. If you're in, I follow a lot of financial people on Twitter. I think there's some smart people out there. You never heard about fiat debasement. It's never talked about. Maybe because, you know, we weren't forced to confront it as a sort of a political culture like we are now. So I think BPI definitely benefits from a change in the zeitgeist about where people see the fiscal situation is, and clearly they look for opportunity. They look for options, right? Okay, we're in deep shit here. What do we do? What's an option? No, well, there's this thing called Bitcoin that these people are talking about. Let's hear them out. Listen to them, and the message resonates. And so I do think there's timing, like everything else in the world. Good timing helps. Shilling a good product helps. But I think we hit it at the right time, with the right message as a solution to some of what I think there's nothing else in DC. There's a consensus that we can't continue on the same path. Now, does everybody believe that Bitcoin is an option? No. Do a lot of people? Yeah. And, you know, our job is to make that second group bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. And apologies, it looks like my camera and mic switched. So
that's all good.
The audio sounds a bit different. But on that note, what can we expect in 16 days at the Policy Institute? What would you like to get out of this great gathering in DC this year?
So I think, you know, we did BFA back in March, and that was sort of to mark the new administration. That was to mark the establishment of the SBR. I think now the idea is to set now that we've gone through these basic wins, and I think we've sort of the turn toward Bitcoin in DC, at least temporarily, has been solidified. You know, the idea is to set the policy agenda for the end of this Congress. And a lot of our focus is going to be on national security. We have a couple panels, people, Michael Ellis, I've mentioned before, but some others, will talk about Bitcoin and changing global order. Which, as you read, like, you know, Matt Bynes, you know, our executive director, writes prolifically about that. He'll be on stage a lot, as will I, talking to people about this sort of thing. The idea part of being in a think tank is to put policies out there, right? We want to give DC the agenda for a Bitcoin future, and that's what we're going to do on June 25th.
Well, Ken, thank you for all that you do and for joining me for this conversation.
Awesome.
It was fascinating.
Yeah, it was great.
Again, even though hand up, been highly skeptical of the CIA on this show for many years, and I've never had anybody who's worked for the CIA on. So thank you for coming on, and maybe over some drinks we can talk about some of my my deeper theories on the CIA. But
deeper fears
as it pertains to Bitcoin policy. I think that's the beauty of it. As we discussed, it's binary. The only winning move is to play, and you may not care about political power, but political power cares about you. And I think it's incredibly important that we have people like yourself in positions advocating for Bitcoin as a protocol, developers as individuals building on the protocol, and really putting the case forward for Bitcoin as a economic and geopolitical strategic asset that Americans need to dominate. And as an American citizen, and somebody cares deeply about Bitcoin and the future of America, as an individual who has a small but growing family with young children, I think this is important work that for a long time in my Bitcoin career, I'd say like the first 5 or 6 years, I was one of those people who said, don't even talk to the government. It's not worth it. They hate you and they're not going to work with you.
But and maybe they did. I'll leave with one thought. I tell people this all the time. Like, don't underestimate your voice. Every time I talk, I leave them with this thought. You know, call your congressman. If you have a Bitcoin meetup, call your member of Congress and invite them to come. They may send a staff member, and then, you know, they'll come once or twice. They may show up themselves. Don't be afraid to engage. Be polite. Tell them you're a Bitcoiner. Tell them you want them to support legislation that's pro-Bitcoin. And you'd be surprised if they get enough phone calls, they start sending people to your events and they start listening. So I can't emphasize enough the importance of doing that. It seems like you're sort of yelling at the clouds. But believe me, enough voices, keep those phones ringing, they start to listen. So if people have any questions about who the representatives are or how to find them, feel free to just reach out to BPI. We're happy to help you with that. But I really, really encourage people to do that. It's very, very important. And actually, at the end of the day, if people do it enough, it actually does work.
Yeah, and as it pertains to the summit, right? There's, if you're in the industry and you're interested in going, you should still reach out. There's still time, correct?
There's still time, yes. If you want to, feel free to hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Bayman11771. Feel free to hit me up on Twitter. Or you can visit the summit website. Maybe Marty can post that in the notes. It is btcpolicysummit.org.
Awesome. We will link to that. Ken, good luck on the Hill today.
Thanks, Marty.
You look good. You look confident. I think it's going to be a good conversation. I'm going to change some minds. And I'll see you in DC in a few weeks.
Appreciate you. You know it. All right. Have a good one. Thanks.
All right. Peace and love, freaks.
Freaks, thank you for listening to the show. I hope you liked it. If you did like it, please make sure you subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps us out a lot. And also, if you like these conversations, I've come to realize that many people listen to the podcast. They don't know we have another sort of layer of this media company. We have the newsletter, the Bitcoin Brief. Go to tftc.io. Make sure you subscribe there. A lot of the topics that are discussed on this podcast, I write about 5 days a week in the newsletter. We also have the TFTC Elite tier. You sign up for that, become a member. We have a private Discord server for the elite freaks out there where we're dropping ad-free versions of this show and having discussions about everything we talk about. A day early. Logan wanted me to make sure if you want to get the show a day early, become a TFTC elite member, you will get that. We have our Discord server. Right now it's conversation between myself and TFTC elite tier members, but we're going to expand that. We'll probably do closed Q&As with people in the industry. I may be doing Macro Mondays. So join us. Go to tftc.io. Subscribe. Find the button in the top right corner of the website. Become a TFTC Elite member. Thank you for joining us. Okay.